That was Branford Marsalis from the album Random Abstract. And I could say what I think about it, which is, I guess, that I love it a lot. But since we have Branford Marsalis here, I think I'll ask Branford if there's anything you'd like to say about that lovely Ornette Coleman tune, Lonely Woman, in that recording, and some of the things you were thinking of or doing at the time.
Oh, well, that was during that period when we were pushing away from harmony, really, and focusing in on melody and playing other people's songs, whose songs that were significantly better than ours, which was unusual at that time in the '80s because everybody was, you know, it's like Art Blakey was a drummer and Miles Davis was a trumpet player and Coltrane was a saxophone player, but by the '80s they would say things like saxophonist and composer. So you guys are into this, like you're writing their own compositions, and with the way that I grew up listening to music, I'm like, well, it's like, Rodgers and Hart and, Tchaikovsky are not the same thing. So if that's what composition is, as opposed to being songwriting, then we have to come up with another word for what those guys, Tchaikovsky and those guys do, because they're not the same thing. And given all of those factors, I never really spent much time. I was putting all of my energies into learning how to be a player. So I wasn't really worried so much about putting my own compositions on, since I wasn't putting in any time trying to actually write songs. I wasn't trying to be a songwriter. So we were always playing other people's songs. And down the road, that helped me with my own compositions because I had a better musical vocabulary. So my songs don't tend to sound the same.
Well, that's already getting into quite a few interesting topics for my thinking. But first, I want to say thank you for coming in, Branford. Welcome to Spokane Public Radio. Really, really glad to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
And glad that you're here to perform with Whitworth. A couple things right out of the gate I should mention. There's a clinic tonight, right? 5:15, is that correct?
Ask Dan. Dan knows these things.
5:15 at Whitworth University Coles Auditorium. Free clinic with Branford Marsalis. It's open to anybody. There'll be people there from ages 8 to 80, probably.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people.
And we're treating everything, rubella, measles.
Yeah, oh, that kind of clinic.
It's free clinic.
Excellent.
That's, come on in.
That's a big relief to a lot of folks, I'm sure. Now, that's going to be fun. And the clinic, is it emphasizing sax or reed playing, or is it jazz in general?
I think my clinics tend to focus on music more than a specific thing.
Yeah.
Because all music is the same, and all of it is not the same at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
What I kind of figured out talking to my students, who are very combative, which I like, and resistant, which is normal. The way I kind of swayed them around, turned them around with this idea of actually listening to jazz to play jazz. What a novel mm-hmm. idea! Imagine that. I said, well, Jimi Hendrix and Wolfgang Mozart actually used the exact same 12 notes. So clearly it's not the notes that make these things different. It's how those notes sound.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you going to use a book to get to sound?
Mm-hmm.
And when I said that, they would stop, and I watched their little brains churning, they go, wow. Well, okay. And I knew they'd be back next week with more foolishness because they don't want to do what I asked them to do, and I understand that I have children. I know all about that. I was that child. I know all about that. So, my clinics are more about sound and music and listening,
mm-hmm.
not about saxophone stuff, which is kind of nerdy and useless in a lot of ways. Anyway.
And so the clinic tonight at 5:15 at Whitworth, and then the concert's tomorrow at the Fox, right? At
8? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you don't want to miss that.
That's right.
That's going to be some great, great tunes we're going to be playing.
Landon's going to be there, too. So
yeah, he is.
Very cool. Well, you're talking about the music as opposed to the songs, and I want to get into that a little bit. I've got some questions that are at least ancillary to that. I really respond to both of the sides of musicians who play their own compositions, which I think is real important for composing to be part of the reflection of your art. But I also get something out of hearing a song that I know, so I've got a frame of reference for judging or enjoying how an individual artist may treat something that's this like a jazz standard. Right. I think both are important, but talk to us, if you would, a little bit about both of those things.
I think that they're two separate things. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're just as a gross overgeneralization, I think one of the reasons that jazz composition is so weak right now is because the musicians seem to spend all of their time validating whatever system it is that they've embraced rather than expanding and trying to make everything better. Everything is kind of designed to justify the way of playing. And one of the reasons that, well, Stan Getz is one of the reasons. This is actually a great story. Because we were in the 80s, we were doing this burnout thing. We would play ballads and we play fast tunes. And the tunes didn't have chord structure and we would just be firing and doing all of this stuff. And sometime in the 80s, it was the only time I ever talked to Stan. We were opening up for Stan Getz in London. So I saw Stan and I said, well, Mr. Getz, I'm looking forward to hearing you tonight. Hey. And no, it's the thing you're standing on. Yeah. Otherwise, carry on. So I was talking to, I said, Mr. Getz, I'm looking forward to hearing you. He says, oh, you're going to come? I said, I'm going to be there. He says, yeah, because I've heard you play and you could use some, you could use this. You need to listen to me play. And in my mind, I went, well, what a jerk. So we're going to fix him. So we tried to play our most complicated music and the sound was bouncing all off the wall. And the audience said, one of the guys in the audience said, we can't hear a note you guys are playing. And a third of the audience applauded. But at that time, that was the only way that I knew how to play. So Stan comes out. The room is boomy. He surveils the room, and then he walks away from the mic, and he basically plays ballads and soft songs and sambas all night, and the audience goes absolutely bananas. And he walked by, and he says, well, did we learn anything tonight? And I said, we sure did. He goes, very good. And he walked away, and that was the only time I ever spoke to him. But the thing that I walked away from that learning is that, and I told the guys in the band, we need to learn how to play more than what we play. We need to learn how to actually be jazz musicians. And because that's what Stan did. He walked out, he checked out the room, and he played the room. And mm-hmm. he played music that worked in the room. If I had played that style of music, it would have been a fail because I lacked the vocabulary to play in that style. And so that was like 88. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started my whole serious campaign about learning how to play all styles of jazz. Because like Art Blakey told me when I was stubborn and young, Miles Davis didn't learn how to play like Miles Davis by listening to tapes of himself in the future. I mean, he grew up listening to Louis Armstrong and Clark Terry. Those were his guys. And Louis Armstrong and Clark Terry equals Miles Davis. What I know now is like Lester Young plus Charlie Parker equals Dexter Gordon. I know this because I have the original recordings when Dexter used to sound just like Lester. 1944, he sounds like Lester. 1948, he sounds like Bird. Yeah. And then 50s, it was like both of those things come together and create this sound. And I have all of these recordings now because of digital technology. I have all these recordings of Coltrane and his nascence, these bootlegs and all this stuff that kind of affirms that all the great musicians have gone through a process, as opposed to the myth that you hear that they were just naturally gifted and great, and when they were 15, they were tearing the world up. Mm-hmm. When you listen to Charlie Parker playing with Jay McShann in 1941, he was not tearing the world up. But you could hear that the world, in retrospect, was about to be torn up. But he was not there. I was a recording of Coltrane playing in the 1954, and they have a recording of him 7 years prior playing Ornithology and sounding completely horrible. And then 7 years later, he's playing a jump blues with Johnny Hodges' band and killing it, like a walk the bar blues. The thing that a lot of guys that love Coltrane and identify with him, they identify with his kind of antisocial streak and the fact that he would come on the stage and, you know, he wouldn't smile and he would play all of this incredibly difficult stuff. But he learned how to do the simple stuff, too. Mm-hmm. That's what gave the complicated stuff gravitas.
Yeah, earlier today I was playing that In a Sentimental Mood with Duke Ellington.
Yeah,
and
it's
John
incredible.
Coltrane. And it's just so sweet
it's
and
incredible.
So lovely. And there's just so much to that they wrung out of that.
And when all of us as kids, we immediately gravitate towards the I Want to Talk About You on Live at the Vanguard, where he takes a 10-minute cadenza with all of this complicated, crazy stuff, when in fact, it's a mistake to start there, because that is a place that Coltrane arrived to. He didn't start there. And we would, of course, start there because we fell in love with the technical difficulty and paid no attention to the musicianship. And I was lucky enough to kind of stumble into the concept of jazz as music, not so much of as a harmonic exercise or a harmonic device, but as so I had to start listening to a lot of stuff that I thought was horrible music at the time. I started listening to Slim Gaillard and Slam Stewart, to Slim and Slam,
oh, yeah.
And to the alto player, Louis Jordan, and Syl Austin, and all of these things that are related, because Blakey knew all these songs. He said, you got to learn all these songs, man. You got to learn all these songs, like Ain't What You Do, How You Way That You Do It, and all these things from McKinney's Cotton Pickers. And I was resistant to that because that's not why I wanted to play jazz. But at some point after the Stan Getz thing, I realized that the gateway to playing the way I want to play is in understanding the old music.
But that's the kind of thing that comes with age, at least to the degree that I can understand what you're saying. These things happened to me over my life, but I had to get older to get past the flash and the fast, choppy kinds of stuff. You know, I had to say I hated Frank Sinatra for a decade or more before I started actually listening to some of the stuff that had the gems in there that I needed to still learn. Right. And I had to learn to like the slow, beautiful stuff.
Right.
But, you know, when you're young, you don't have the patience. You know,
even when you're old sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of guys that play jazz right now that are my age and never bothered.
Yeah.
They just never bothered to go back and get it.
And yeah.
I don't envy them. I don't envy them.
Well, there's a lot of jazz in schools. I noticed that the level of musicianship of young kids just keeps on going up and up. That bar just keeps on rising. We've had kids playing live music in our studio that are really bit, really deep. They're really getting into this. And I know these things are happening, but I still want to ask you, what kinds of things do you think of specifically to try to help keep jazz being relevant to the younger generation?
I would push back against that, actually.
Yeah?
What we have are the instrumentalism keeps getting higher and higher.
Mm-hmm.
There's the way that young men and young women play the instruments are astounding right now, technically. Musically, it's another story.
Mm.
When you think about some of the options that the musicians choose, like can't play a ballad, just kind of play the melody half-heartedly and go into the two feel and start ripping, which is the standard operating procedure for a jazz group. Everybody plays off of a two feel, then you don't have to really learn how to play a ballad. Modern jazz songs are many, many of them now, or tend to be odd meter songs with an ostinato bass line. Mm-hmm. And everybody kind of solos on that form, so the songs don't have that forward motion that music had in the 40s. It's just kind of static motion, and everybody solos on this thing that just hovers in the air and doesn't go anywhere. So I don't really find that to be very good musically, but the stuff that they're playing on those things are technically amazing, what guys are playing. But I always equate music to sports. Like the bass player in a jazz band is kind of like the center on a football team. And the center doesn't have to run the 40, sub 5. You know, that's not what his job is. So we have a lot of centers in jazz who want to be wide receivers.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I learned from listening to early jazz is that all of the musicians understood what their function was in a group. And because everybody's function is the same now. The main vehicle of all jazz bands is soloing. So everybody's playing the same solo information. If you listen to a record of the 40s, trumpet players didn't sound like sax players. Now they sound just like sax players, mm-hmm. as do piano players mm-hmm. and bass players.
Sure.
They all, because they're all basically playing the same solo.
Same bag of tricks that you do when you see a G minor seventh chord, you play this bag of tricks.
Yeah.
To combat that, what kind of things are you recommending? Listening.
You have to listen to music.
Yeah.
It's like what I was telling Dan yesterday, what I did with my students is I pulled out a piece of Baroque music and I put it on the stand. I said, "Hey, go play this." You know, because they were really pushing back. They didn't want to listen to the music the way I wanted them to listen to it. I said, "Here, play this." I said, "It sounds horrible. Why does it sound horrible?" He says, "Well, I don't know any Baroque music." I said, "But according to you, music is a flat plane. So here are the 12 notes, same 12 notes that Charlie Parker played. It should sound Baroque. Or maybe I can write some little phrases down there to tell you what to do and then you just do it, right?" And you watch them try to say, I say, "Well, how can you get better at this?" And of course, the answer is, "Well, I have to listen to it first." And they did not want to say that. They were like Fonzie trying to apologize on Happy Days. Go on, you can say it. I got to listen to it. Say, yeah, imagine that. You know, and it's just, there are things you can do to make them see what the problem is or hear what the problem is. Now, whether they choose to address that or not, that's another story entirely. But I try to really go out of my way to make them understand, well, this is the thing that's going to make you better. And I had one student who was just didn't want to hear it. And I talked to him 2 months ago, and he had been out of school for 3 years. And he calls me and he says, "I'm kind of stuck in a rut. I'm just playing the same crap over and over again, and I hate it." And I said, "Well, do you remember what we actually talked about 7 years ago?" And he stopped for a second. He goes, "Yeah, I wasn't really ready to hear that back then." I said, "So what's different now?" It's like, why are you calling me? You know what you need to do. Go do it. But there's like a resistance, which I don't understand. Mm-hmm. It's just like, what is the thing? Well, musicians don't hear that well. That's one of the things. But it's an acquired skill, like everything else. It's an acquired skill. You have to work at it.
And you have to grow a little bit before you even start asking those questions or start being, you know, comfortable or ready for it. I know I certainly have changed what I, mostly I was declarative about what I didn't like, you know, like, as if it was important to my, who I am, to declare this list of things I didn't like. And then over the years, each one of them just keeps, well, I hear another good example of, country music. Well, that's awful sweet, so I guess I can't say I don't like country anymore.
But right. The club mentality. I mean, we all, this is America. We're the land of clubs. So I remember when Garth Brooks was really successful in the 90s, and you had guys walking around on the streets and going to his concerts wearing the same stuff that he wears, those striped shirts with the black cowboy hat. And I'm like, what's with the uniforms? You know, the hip-hop guys with the baggy pants and the Timberlands and their underwear hanging out. It's like, okay, so you like the music. Do you have to dress that way? It was like there's this kind of silent social requirement that you had to declare what it was that you were, and you could only be that thing. You couldn't be multiple things. And I was just lucky. I was lucky. I didn't fall for that one.
And I think it's easy to, when you want to, there's something that you love and you want to imitate it and to imitate the surface details rather than to imitate what that artist actually did, which was compose all their own material to grow to a point to where they can develop.
Well, most jazz guys did not compose their own material. Come on. Lester Young didn't compose anything. Like a couple of tunes. Lester Leaps In and the other one that I can sing but can't remember the name of. You know, Charlie Parker didn't really compose anything. Miles Davis didn't compose anything. Clifford Brown didn't compose anything. Johnny Hodges didn't compose anything. Ellington composed.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Basie's band was a riff band. You know, and then there were like songs. There were songwriters. They played popular songs of the day. And there's this new, like I said, this new unhealthy obsession with composition because, I mean, most of the guys aren't very good at it. And they're not doing what they need to do to get good at it, which is listen to people who are good at it. They believe in the formula of, well, you know, if I just write, you know, I think that you should write a song a day. But with no new information, it's going to sound like the last song. It's like you're basically, with limited amounts of information, where can this go? So my argument is always, if you really want to be good at it, you have to expand your vocabulary. So you should be listening to Ellington because of the way he wrote, not to imitate in detail the style of his music, but there's a way that he wrote. One of the things that made his music unique to me is that he didn't write for sections, whereas the traditional way to write a big band is trumpet section parts, sax section parts, trombone.
He was writing for the individuals?
He was writing, he had their names on it personally, right. But it wasn't that. It's just what would traditionally be a third trumpet part, the alto had it. And what was traditionally a tenor part, the trombone had it. So when you lined it up, it wasn't just like the song, like there's this section, and this section, and they start and stop at the same time.
It wasn't the usual patterns, yeah.
It was just, you could tell that he was hearing what he was doing. He wasn't just following a formula. And the formula works, and it swings sometimes, and it's great. But, Ellington was unique. I mean, Gustav Mahler is unique, and Beethoven's unique, and these are all the people that one needs to listen to if composition is their thing. Because it's not really about trying to write like a specific person for me. I started listening to Wagner a lot. I said, what do you hope to learn from that? Are you trying to write like that? I said, no, I'm trying to hear like that. Because if I can hear a central melody, a secondary melody, and a tertiary melody, and find a way to orchestrate it for 60 people, I got something going on in my head. Mm-hmm. Whereas in jazz, what are we trying to do? It's like we're like glorified pop music. You know, find a catchy melody, write out this single line, and everybody plays on the line. It's like there's no idea to challenge what the band plays conceptually. It's like everything follows the same conception. It's like everything, that's why everything sounds the same. Because every song is approached from the same lens, and what I've worked on especially the last 20 years is just putting on different colored lenses for every song, depending on what the sound of the song is. We're going to approach this based on what the sound of the song is. That will affect what I play. I won't try to take every song and put it through my own personal meat grinder and churn out the same piece of sausage.
So it seems like you're saying essentially do your homework, learn to play, learn to listen to a lot of music, a lot of varied styles of music, as well as the artists that you like a lot. And
precisely.
Maybe try to
listen listen to the people that the people you like listen to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's the one when Blakey was. If you really want to try to play like John Coltrane, listening to John Coltrane is not the answer. Listening to the people he listened to is the answer, mm-hmm. in addition to listening to Coltrane. And when I finally started doing that, I heard Coltrane in a completely different way than I'd heard it before. And the same thing happened with Charlie Parker. Buddy Tate, was a tenor man, played with a bassist band.
Yeah.
And he comes up to me. All the old guys knew that I was open to criticism. So they were happy to dispense wisdom. Where we were in that weird part in the 80s where everything was like, what, are you disrespecting me? Like that's when that thing really started, the whole, you know, hateration and all this stuff that you hear. But they were just dispensing wisdom, and they were very direct, which is the way I like it. And he said two things to me. He says, you're one of the worst ballet players I ever heard. And I said, yeah, I'm working on that. And he says, so what are you doing? I said, I'm listening to Ben Webster every day. He says, well, you can't go wrong with Ben. He said, that's going to work out for you. I said, yeah, but what else should I do? He says, no, that's it. He says, listen to Billie Holiday, listen to people who can play ballads, listen to Rabbit, Johnny Hodges, and then just go out there and play two ballads a night. I said, but they sound terrible. He says, yeah, but they ain't no way to get better except to sound terrible till it don't sound terrible no more. And I just never heard anybody say that to me before. Yeah. And I was like, man, that makes so much sense. It can't be that easy. And I went out there and I sounded like garbage for 2 years. And at the end of the second year, it didn't sound like garbage anymore. And I went, I got my template now. And the other thing he told me was that, he says, you young boys are never going to learn how to play bebop until you understand that bebop is just swing music. He says, Charlie Parker didn't invent a new style of music. He added a new branch to a tree.
Yeah.
He says, and you guys don't know anything about the tree. You pretend that the branch is the tree. And when he said that, I went, okay. It was really like that, like you said, you know, with gritted teeth. I was like, okay, I got to go listen to Basie. Great. You know, I got to go listen to Ellington. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Just really. Mm-hmm. And month in, it's like, wow, this is incredible. But then when I heard Parker, and suddenly I heard all the rhythm that was built into the way he phrased. I wasn't just focused on the notes that he played.
Well, it sure has been a whole lot of fun talking with you, and I would love nothing more than to keep talking, because this is a favorite subject of mine, and
right.
I could go on, and I can tell you could too. But I sure want to thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
I need to remind people that the clinic is tonight at 5:15 at Whitworth College, and the concert is tomorrow at the Fox, beginning at 8 o'clock. Branford Marsalis is a guest artist with the Whitworth Jazz Ensemble, Dan Keberly directing. So I thank you so much for coming in. It's been just
a pleasure.
A real pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure's mine.